This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're featuring leaders of some of the great big bands on this archive edition. In the 1930s and 40s, the Artie Shaw Band ranked with the Goodman, Dorsey, and Miller bands in popularity. The Shaw Band made one of its most popular records at its first recording session in 1938. It was a song by Cole Porter called Begin the Begin. Artie Shaw's huge popular success brought unexpected torments. He temporarily left music in 1939, frustrated with a performing career that he came to think of as 90% business and 10% art. That was neither the first nor the last time he left music. In 1954, Shaw began a nearly 30-year retirement from music and permanently gave up the clarinet. After writing two books and becoming a film producer, Shaw returned to music in 1980 to organize a new big band, although he chose another musician, Dick Johnson, to play the solo clarinet parts and front the band. Now Artie Shaw is in retirement. When I spoke with him in 1985, he told me why he recorded Begin the Begin. Keep in mind, it was a virtually unknown song when he recorded it.
It was one of Cole Porter's few flop tunes and from one of his very few flop shows, Jubilee. I happened to get to the theater on Friday, the show closed Saturday, and I just heard that tune, and it was done in a kind of Latin beat. And I liked the melody. It was a hell of a good song. It still is. And a very big departure from most popular songs of those days, which were 8-8, Bridge and 8, or 8-8 and then 8-8. I mean, 1-2, 1-2. So I heard the tune, and I came back. I was looking for an identity for the band. I told you we were looking for good songs from sophisticated songwriters. So I said to Jerry Gray, let's do Begin the Begin. He didn't know what the tune was. We got a copy, and we sat down and worked out the arrangement that everybody now knows. And I had no idea it was going to, you know, the other side of a record that we thought was going to be the big one. It's always been true. Frenzy was the other side of a record we thought was going to be a big one. Nobody knows what's going to be the hit. I'll tell you an interesting story about Stardust, the record that I have. Harry Meyerson was then A&R man, whatever that is for, they didn't have A&R men, but he was a production manager for RCA Records in California. It was then Victor. He came to me one day, said, the company wants to try a stunt if you'd be willing to participate in. We'd like to do a two-sided version. They had 78s in those days, A and B side. We're going to do a side with no A, we're a record with no A or B. You and Tommy Dorsey are our two biggest sellers, and we want to put each of you on one side of the two-sided record, Stardust, big song. We'd like to have each of you do your own version of it. Do whichever you want, you know, 3 1/4-minute version. So I did that. I had this string section with the band, went in, made the record. I did a sketch. Lenny Hayton did the orchestration, and we put it together and went in, did one version, and left, take one. And I said, it's not going to get any better, so we left. About 3 weeks later, I talked to Harry. I said, I heard Tommy was in. I hadn't spoken to him, but I heard he was in. Did he make his side? He said, no, he didn't. You're going to have to come in and make 3 more sides so we can have a 4-record release. I said, why? He said, Tommy came in the studio with his men, and he said, let me hear what Artie did. So I played him the record. He heard it on those big speakers, and he said, I'm not going to get on the other side of that. he would have sold 16 million records if he got on this other side. But Tommy and I never had any invidiousness. We were very good friends. And he respected that record.
Did you like his band?
Tommy? Oh, he was a good musician. Tommy never made a bad record in his life. I thought he made some cheap shot things, but at his best, and I think everybody's got a right to be judged by his best, at his best, he was a phenomenal guy.
From your perspective, who were the best band leaders of that time?
Well, I don't know. You can't rate them in any order, but I would say the prominent ones were Dorsey, Goodman, myself, Basie, Ellington, Before that, there was Lunsford. Chick Webb was there. Fletcher wrote some nice arrangements, but his band never was all that good. He had some good players. He had Coleman, he had Tricky Sam, he had Louis Armstrong for a while. He had great players in his band. But as a band leader, he didn't have the kind of rigid, iron-like discipline you need to run a band.
The early bands that you played with were bands that you called entertaining bands. Like,
that's all there was. Yeah. There were no jazz bands then that you could make a living in. I mean, if you were lucky enough to be black, you could play jazz, because that's the only music they had in the ghettos. But I was playing in the white world. And in the white world, there was no room to play jazz and make a living. So I ended up at the best jobs there were, studio work. And there it got to be utterly incredible. You were playing things like Manhattan Merry-Go-Round, the Lucky Strike Hit Parade. Well, that's scary. You're playing as a true what they like. What was it true what they say about Dixie for 13 weeks in a row? That can be enough to drive any halfway decent musician clear out of his head.
You had said that when you were playing for the entertaining bands that you started to really hate the whole concept of showmanship.
I still do.
What were the kinds of showmanship antics that people in the band were called on to perform?
Glenn Miller's band waving the trombones around from side to side as they play, saxophones holding their instruments up in the air and doing everything but playing serious music. The guys in my band one night, I came back to the band. I'd left them for about 3 weeks. They were out on the road. And they were playing a tune that I wrote for the band called, an arrangement I made called Lady Be Good. At the end of the last chorus, the band does something, the saxophones do a fast kind of whinny trill, and the guys for kicks were holding their horns up, and the trombones were doing that, and I looked at them, I was appalled. I said, what are you guys doing? They said, oh, it's for fun. I said, the audience doesn't know it's fun. They think you're doing showmanship, and if we have to do showmanship, that means we're very insecure about the music. Sit down and respect what you do. If you don't, they won't. And they heard that.
One sign of success, I think, when you were performing is if people were dancing. What did you think of dancing? You have that famous comment that all jitterbuggers are morons.
I didn't say all.
Okay. did you not like it when people danced?
I don't care what they do. It has no meaning to me. What I care about is if they come there and buy a ticket and support the band. That's really all that matters. And if they like it, that's great. If they don't like it, I'm still doing what I got to do. Dancing is totally irrelevant. If you want to dance, a windshield wiper will do it. All you need is a beat. You don't need what we do, you know.
In the 30s and early 40s, a common question that people would ask was, well, who do you think is really the king? Is it Artie or Benny? Were you aware of that whole public competition?
How could
between
I not be?
Goodman?
I was part of that controversy. That it makes no bloody sense. We weren't doing the same things. The fact is we played a clarinet. We each played a clarinet. But the music was different. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you an interesting little anecdote. I had occasion to talk to Benny about something once that I wanted to do, and I needed him, and I needed the Dorsey people, and I needed the Stan Kenton and Guy Lombardo and all of the big band leaders. And I got okay from everybody. Goodman didn't want to do it. And he kept asking me questions about clarinet players. What do you think about so-and-so? What do you think about this guy, that guy? I said, this guy's too schmaltzy, that guy's too rigid. Knowing what he expected me to say, and I was zinging him a little bit. So I said, finally, Benny, you're too hung up on the clarinet. And he looked at me and says, that's what we do, isn't it? I said, no, I'm trying to play music. I'm not interested in clarinet. It's a means. It's an instrument. You use an instrument to do something with. And I saw a tiny light bulb go on in his eyes. I don't think he ever seriously considered the idea that the clarinet was a means, not an end.
We're featuring a 1985 interview with Artie Shaw. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Artie Shaw. When you were leading a jazz band, the bands were still pretty segregated. There were black bands and white bands.
In New York City, there was a local union, 802, white. Then there was a Harlem union for blacks. There was no way if you could mix. The only thing you could do on records now and then, you'd play with a black guy. I'd get on a record. There would be Coleman Hawkins there or Lester or whoever, Cozy Cole playing drums. Rarely was there a white. Well, there were no black playing with white musicians.
Well, when you hired Billie Holiday, she was, I believe, the first black singer to perform with a white band.
To work in a white band, steadily, sure, as a member of the band. She didn't come out as a specialty act. See, I mean, when Benny Goodman had, say, Lionel and Teddy Wilson, they came out as a separate thing. They weren't in the band. When I had Lips Page, he sat in the band. Roy Eldridge was in the band. I had Zooty Singleton in my band in 1937. Well, that was unheard of. We played the Million Dollar Pier. People said, isn't he a black man? I said, well, he's hardly that tan. But it was very, very nip and tuck. People used very, very angry at it.
Were there places you couldn't play with Billie Holiday?
No, no. We went to the South. That was difficult because Billie had a short fuse and people would say things about it and she would blow. So I always had a guy ready to spirit her away, put her in a bus and get her out because she would blow. She'd call a guy every kind of MF you could think of. And they didn't take that too well. See, they would refer to as, they would say, have the nigger wench sing another song. I couldn't believe my ears. I'd say, you mean Billie singing another song? No, the nigger wench. That's what they thought of her as.
Was there any pressure on you by the men in the band to not have any black performers in it? Did anyone ever say, look, you know, you're going to lose us?
Hell
gigs
no.
We can't
the
it.
Men loved her, and they loved Lips, and they loved Roy. I mean, these were sterling performers. I would have liked to have four of them, but about one was all I could handle. The people would not accept much more.
You enlisted during World War II and ended up playing with your band on
the Pacific
Front.
Yeah.
Did you know when you enlisted that you'd be mostly performing? Was that the arrangement that was made?
No, I had no idea what I was going to be doing. I was on the stage in Providence, Rhode Island, when I went back in the wings while a dance act went on. We were doing an hour show, as they called it. And the stagehand's radio was on, and we were hearing a hysterical announcer talking about the Japs having bombed Pearl Harbor. I had to go back out on stage. Just before I went out, I got a note from the manager, please announce that all military personnel is to report to its bases immediately. This was right near Newport, where there was a sub base, a naval base, an Air Force base, all that. So I went out on stage and did that, and about three quarters of the house got empty. I hadn't realized, you know, you take it for granted, men were more and more people showing up in uniforms. World War II was out there, but it seemed somehow distant. And when the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor, I suddenly had to see myself. I got a kind of Satori view of myself going out there and saying, now, ladies and gentlemen, our next tune will be. It sounded so irrelevant to this conflagration that World War II represented to me that I thought, I can't do this. I did it, announced the tune. I think it was Stardust. And as the band started playing, I turned to Les Robinson, who was in the first row saxophone players. He was the lead. And I said, Les, pass the word, 2 weeks' notice. Total impulse. And 3 weeks later, I was down on Church Street enlisting in the Navy. I just felt that there was no place for me as a civilian. This was the big experience of my life. Had to be part of it. I don't know, or I didn't at that time, know that much about why Hitler was there, but I knew we had something to do with it. And I figured no matter how he got there, we had to stop him. In any case, I joined the Navy, and I went in as an apprentice seaman, as low as you could get. I could have become a commander if I'd wanted to. I didn't know that. I knew Forrestal, who was then undersecretary. And when I joined up, I had seen him, and he said, if you get in trouble, come see me. Well, after about 6 or 8 weeks of minesweeper duty or Staten Island, this, that, and the other, I found myself doing what an apprentice seaman does. I thought the Navy would have enough rationality to put me into the job I could do best for them and then give me whatever rate or rank I needed for that. I was very naive, you know. I didn't realize that the military service doesn't operate rationally. They looked at one stripe or no stripe, and they gave me a swab the deck sailor. Well, that's kind of stupid. I was building shelves under a stairway to put mops and buckets on. So I went to see Forrestal. I went AWOL, went down there and saw him in his office. And he laughed, and he said, all right, I'll put you in touch with somebody. And I got in touch with the head of enlisted men, a man named Admiral Bledsoe. And he gave me carte blanche to get a band together. He said, what do you want to do? I said, what do you want me to do? He said, get a band together. It's the best you can do for us. Where? I said, where's the Navy? He said, in the Pacific. I said, okay. So he gave me total carte blanche. I enlisted a bunch of guys who were 1A. And got the best band that ever was. That band was a tremendous band. We won the Esquire Poll and all that. We traveled all over the Pacific in places where the Bob Hopes couldn't go. We went to forward areas. We were on battleships. We were on aircraft carriers. We were all over the place.
Artie Shaw, recorded in 1985. This is his band's 1939 recording of Rose Room. Artie Shaw did the arrangement. Thank you. This is Fresh Air.